Saudis of Arabia. In early March, Congress overwhelmingly passed the resolution. The Eisenhower Doctrine was no improvisation. It formed part of Eisenhower's grand strategy for waging and winning the Cold War, a contest that would unfold especially in the developing world. European countries under Soviet rule, such as Poland and Hungary, could not be saved by American actions. Referring specifically to Hungary, Ike coldly told the press a week after his re-election that the United States did not advocate open rebellion by an undefended populace against a force over which they could not possibly prevail. Any kind of armed revolt would only bring disaster. So much for liberating the captive nations. But the Third World was up for grabs. There the contest must be won. Although later historians often praise Eisenhower for his restraint and his aversion to war, in fact, during his first term, he had deployed American power again and again in order to counter what he saw as the Soviet danger in the developing world. In Iran, in 1953, a coup had dispatched a bombastic nationalist leader. In Guatemala, in 1954, U.S.-led subversion ousted a radical left-wing president. In Indochina, Eisenhower had seen off the French colonists. By 1955, Americans were pouring millions of dollars into the client state of South Vietnam. Eisenhower had met Chinese communists' threats to Taiwan by appealing to Congress for a free hand to respond to any attack and openly threatened to unleash nuclear weapons. The Seventh Fleet stood on permanent picket duty in the watery channel between the two Chinas. And in the Middle East, in 1956, Eisenhower again expanded the range of American global commitments. Not content to compel his European allies to stand down from their ill-conceived Suez adventure, he now sought to impose an American order on the Middle East. Of course, the Eisenhower Doctrine was expressed in the language of self-determination and liberty, but beneath the finery of good intentions lay the cold steel of military power. In January 1957, Eisenhower declared that the United States would fight to protect its interests in the Middle East. More than six decades later, it is fighting still. Part 3. Race, Rockets, and Revolution. Chapter 14. The Color Line. There must be respect for the Constitution, or we shall have chaos. 1. In the darkness of a warm and humid midnight, a fluttering British Union Jack smartly made its way down a white pole on the top of the National Assembly building in the city of Accra, the capital of the Gold Coast. At 12:01 a.m., precisely, March 6, 1957, the symbol of British rule was replaced by a new standard, a flag bearing three bold stripes of red, yellow, and green, with a black star in the center. The new flag told the world a story. Gold Coast had become the free nation of Ghana. Ghana's independence ceremonies captured world attention. Journalists, political delegates from 70 countries, literary and cultural figures all traveled to Accra to see the historic transfer of power. Speaking to thousands of guests gathered in the city's polo grounds, the nation's new leader, Kwame Nkrumah, declared that Ghana's independence marked the start of a new era of African freedom and the arrival of an African personality in international affairs. Nkrumah, educated in Catholic schools in Ghana, had spent 10 years in the United States in the 1930s, earning academic degrees in economics and theology from Lincoln University and the University of Pennsylvania. From 1947 on, he led a political movement in Gold Coast that gradually wrested political power from the British colonial authorities and put his country on a path to independence. His assumption of power marked the beginning of a new era for the continent. To African-American journalists attending the ceremony, it seemed that the black man of Africa has taken another giant step forward. Among the honored guests at the celebrations was Vice President Richard Nixon, sent by Eisenhower to bear America's good wishes to Ghana. Eisenhower believed that by acclaiming the end of the colonial era and the independence of African peoples, the United States could more readily keep these nations out of the clutches of Soviet influence. In the wake of the Suez Crisis, America had a chance to benefit from its public opposition to the European invasion of Egypt by embracing the global anti-colonial movement. Just a few weeks after his re-election, on December 16, 1956, Eisenhower had welcomed Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru to Washington and devoted almost 3 full days to Nehru during his stay. In an unprecedented gesture of welcome, he took Nehru on an overnight trip to Gettysburg, where they spent 14 hours in private discussions, mostly seated on the glassed-in porch of the Eisenhower home. They walked the farm and gazed companionably at Eisenhower's Black Angus bulls. Mamie honored Nehru's daughter and advisor Indira Gandhi with an elaborate official luncheon in the White House state dining room. Eisenhower understood, he wrote later, that Nehru, as well as many other Asian and African leaders, resented Western condescension, and above all else, they wanted recognition as equals by the white race. Bringing Nehru to Washington for such personal talks, Ike believed, could help demonstrate America's genuine desire to remain on the best possible terms with India, as long as India resisted the blandishments of Khrushchev and the communists. And so Eisenhower, sensitive to the desires of Third World leaders for gestures of respect, asked Nixon to lead the American delegation to the independence celebrations in Ghana. Nixon made the most of it. In typical Nixonian overachieving fashion, he planned a trip of 18,000 miles to 8 African countries: Ghana, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Liberia, Ethiopia, Uganda, and Sudan, bringing his youthful charm, his pretty wife, and his tireless desire to please. His entourage was unusually diverse for the time. It included Congresswoman Frances Bolton of Ohio, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and a specialist on Africa, and a young black Democratic congressman from Michigan, Charles C. Diggs, Jr. Nixon also traveled with Frederick Morrow, the only black member of the White House staff. Asked later what impressed him most about Africa, Morrow quipped, "For the first time in my life, I was a member of the majority, and it was a damn nice feeling." Ghana's historic celebrations attracted other visitors from the United States, notably a delegation of distinguished African Americans expressly invited by Nkrumah. Ralph Bunche of the United Nations was there, along with A. Philip Randolph, the venerable leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. of New York, Lester Granger of the National Urban League, and Martin Luther King, Jr., the pastor from Montgomery, Alabama, who had so recently led the boycott of segregated buses in that city. All these dignitaries, as well as hundreds of other leading Africans, Asians, and Europeans, gathered on March 5th for a reception at the University College of Ghana. Standing just outside the university's large hall, King and Nixon met for the first time. As they shook hands, Nixon smiling warmly, King did not miss his opportunity. "I'm very glad to meet you here," he said, "but I want you to come visit us down in Alabama, for we are seeking the same kind of freedom the Gold Coast is celebrating." An awkward moment. After a pause and without breaking his mirthless smile, Nixon casually invited King to meet with him in Washington upon his return. Ethel Payne, the pioneering black journalist, wryly noted, 8,000 miles away from Washington and even more from Montgomery, Alabama, Reverend King and Vice President Nixon met here and agreed to hold a conference in the nation's capital on the crisis in the South. In the previous months, King had become the face of the African-American civil rights movement. The boycott of public buses in Montgomery had dragged on for a long, difficult year. But in November 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the ruling of a federal 3-judge panel in Browder v. Gale that declared segregation of public buses unconstitutional. When this decision was implemented just before Christmas 1956, allowing blacks to sit anywhere they chose on buses in Montgomery, White vigilantes unleashed a wave of violence, tossing dynamite into the homes of civil rights leaders and blowing up their churches. King's home was hit by a drive-by shotgun blast. Integrated buses were struck by gunfire. A pregnant woman was grievously injured in both legs while riding in a bus across town. On January 10, 1957, the home of King's fellow minister Ralph Abernathy, as well as three churches, were damaged by bombs. King had sent open telegrams to Eisenhower, Nixon, and Attorney General Brownell decrying the violence and beseeching the White House for help. "A state of terror prevails across the South," he declared. He asked the president to use his immense moral power by coming to the South, making a major speech, and condemning these acts of violence. King sent a pointed message to Nixon, questioning why, having conducted a fact-finding mission to Austria to examine the plight of Hungarian refugees fleeing Soviet repression, he would not also come to the South to examine the repression of American citizens there. These appeals did not receive a sympathetic welcome in the White House. When asked about King's plea in a press conference on February 6th, Ike said, "I have a pretty good and sizable agenda on my desk every day, and, as you know, I insist on going for a bit of recreation every once in a while. I have expressed myself on this subject so often in the South, in the North, wherever I have been, that I don't know what another speech would do about the thing right now." In an act of astonishing bad taste, he then departed Washington for 10 days of turkey shooting at the Humphrey Plantation in Georgia. Knowing that Eisenhower was in the South, King sent another telegram asking the president to make a statement denouncing the eruption of violence against blacks. Eisenhower again refused. But the national press noticed. On February 18, 1957, Time magazine put a handsome portrait of King on its cover and published an admiring story about the Montgomery boycott. Across the South, in Atlanta, Mobile, Birmingham, Tallahassee, Miami, New Orleans, Negro leaders looked toward Montgomery, Alabama, the cradle of the Confederacy, for advice and counsel on how to gain the desegregation that the U.S. Supreme Court has guaranteed them. The man whose word they seek is not a judge or a lawyer or a political strategist or a flaming orator. He is a scholarly, 28-year-old Negro Baptist minister, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. There could be no ignoring him now. On that celebratory day in early March in Ghana, as Nixon shook King's hand, he told the young pastor he had read the Time story and enjoyed it. But King represented a serious political challenge to Nixon and Eisenhower. Here was a man who now stood at the head of a powerful social movement, a movement capable of mobilizing millions of people and shining a bright light on America's history of racial segregation and violence. Above all, King's very presence in Ghana revealed the profound hypocrisy of America's policies on race. While the U.S. government acclaimed the birth of freedom in Ghana, it still barred blacks and whites from attending school together, riding buses together, or eating together. Nixon understood all this in a flash and swiftly wriggled away from King's firm handclasp, but Nixon and his president could not run from the issue of civil rights any longer. In 1957, civil rights dominated American politics, and the whole world was watching. 2. At the outset of his second term in office, Eisenhower remained deeply ambivalent about the role the federal government should play in advancing civil rights. On November 14, 1956, while he was preparing with Jim Haggerty for his first post-election press conference, Eisenhower discussed the implications of the Supreme Court's decision the previous day to uphold the ruling in Browder v. Gale that declared unconstitutional the racial segregation of passengers on public buses. He spoke with some bitterness about the topic. The notes of the meeting, taken by his secretary Ann Whitman, reveal his continuing doubts. President said that in some of these things he was more of a state's writer than the Supreme Court. He fears that by some steps the country is going to get into trouble and the problems of the Negroes set back, not advanced. He referred to the schools. said how could the federal government enforce a ruling applying to schools supported by state funds? Said could have a general strike in the South. Feels that even the so-called great liberals are going to have to take a second look at the whole thing. He may say that the Supreme Court does not refer its decisions to him for approval or study. President said that eventually a district court is going to cite someone for contempt, and then we are going to be up against it. These remarks bear careful consideration as they open a door into the real Eisenhower. We hear his devotion to the principle of states' rights. We hear his belief that enforcement of the federal anti-discrimination law as enshrined in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution would actually harm black Americans more than it would help them. We hear him distancing himself from the Supreme Court, whose chief justice he had appointed. We find him anxious about a clash he rightly anticipates between federal courts and local customs. Eisenhower remained a social conservative, a man unused to change, wary of challenging hierarchy. These comments tell us much about where he stood on the great social and moral issue of his time, as he began his second term in office. And yet, and here's the real story, Eisenhower overcame his limitations. Despite his deep-seated aversion to social movements and to the increasingly urgent demands for action on civil rights, he presided over two enormously important developments that would shape the history of race in America. He lent support to Attorney General Brownell's strenuous efforts to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1957, and he used the power of his office to enforce court-ordered school desegregation in Little Rock, Arkansas, overcoming the resistance of the demagogic governor, Orville Faubus. Eisenhower may at times have been an unwilling combatant in these struggles, yet in the end he did act, and decisively, to advance the progress of civil rights. Why did Eisenhower, so wary of the civil rights cause, find himself in the surprising role of abetting it? For one thing, there was the promise of a glittering electoral prize in black votes. Eisenhower received 40% of the African-American vote in 1956, a higher percentage by far than any Republican presidential candidate between 1932 and today. Nixon would win 32% in 1960, but since then, Republican presidential aspirants have managed to garner, on average, only 9.6% of the black vote. While black voters nationally remain sympathetic to the legacy of the New Deal and to the memory of Franklin Roosevelt, Eisenhower started to make inroads into this constituency. He just about doubled his share of the black vote from the election of 1952. More striking than these national numbers, however, were the results in the South. In Atlanta, Ike won 85% of the black vote in 1956, whereas in 1952, he had attracted only 30%. In Richmond, Virginia, he won 73% of the black vote in 1956, against only 22% 4 years earlier. All across the South, the swing of black voters away from the Democrats toward Eisenhower's Republican Party was striking. In cities such as Charleston, Raleigh, Memphis, Nashville, New Orleans, Tampa, Houston, Mobile, and Knoxville, African-American voters switched parties. Of course, the raw totals were tiny. Legal chicanery as well as outright intimidation and brutality kept most Southern blacks away from the polls. Yet the pattern was clear. Those few African-Americans who could vote in the South were moving decisively away from the Democratic Party. Eisenhower attracted these voters not because of his strong stance on civil rights. To be sure, he had accumulated a significant record of progress since 1953, but he did not emphasize it in the 1956 campaign. Rather, black voters in the South turned away from the Democratic Party because of its ferocious hostility to Brown. In the 2 years since the court's decision, white Southern Democrats had openly taken up the cause of white supremacy by signing the Southern Manifesto. In this charged political climate, GOP strategists believed modest progress on civil rights might win over blacks to the Republican Party for a generation. Three important Republicans accepted this argument. Senate Minority Leader William Noland, though an old guard conservative, had his eye on the governorship of California, and maybe even the presidency. To attain either post, he needed black votes. Nixon, also thinking about 1960, had heard the laments of black leaders like Clarence Mitchell, head of the NAACP in Washington, D.C., who said that the Democratic Party has become the party of Eastland, the viciously segregationist senator from Mississippi. Nixon envisioned using black votes to pull southern states out of the Democratic column in the next presidential election. And of course Brownell, the architect of the civil rights program, was determined to get on with the job. He had suffered deep humiliation in the Emmett Till case when he was unable to intervene to rectify a gross miscarriage of justice. So, despite Eisenhower's continuing ambivalence, Brownell picked up the cause again and insisted that civil rights be placed at the top of the administration's legislative agenda. On the last day of December, Eisenhower and Brownell met with key Republican congressional leaders to discuss his domestic priorities, and Brownell, not Eisenhower, made the pitch for civil rights. Noland agreed to work for it, though he despaired of the inevitable Southern filibuster. As a result of these pressures, Eisenhower placed civil rights at the center of his State of the Union address, which he delivered on January 10, 1957. He reiterated the four-point proposal he had submitted to the previous Congress. 1. To create a bipartisan congressional commission to investigate civil rights violations. 2. To create a civil rights division in the Department of Justice under a new Assistant Attorney General. 3. To empower the Attorney General to pursue contempt proceedings against anyone who violated civil rights stemming from the 14th Amendment. And 4. To empower the Attorney General to do the same in connection with a violation of voting rights as laid out in the 15th Amendment. Brownell had succeeded in leading a reluctant president to embrace civil rights legislation by emphasizing the aim of protecting constitutional rights, especially the right to vote. How could that be controversial? Even with the backing of a popular president, however, civil rights legislation faced one enormous hurdle: the U.S. Senate. At the start of the 85th Congress in January 1957, the Democratic Party held a slim majority with 49 seats against the Republicans' 47, unchanged from the previous Congress. 22 of those Democratic senators came from the 11 states of the Confederacy. At least 19 of them were dead set against any civil rights legislation. Since many of those 19 men enjoyed the privileges of seniority and held committee chairmanships, Eastland ran the Judiciary Committee, for instance, it was an easy matter for the South to use the filibuster rules of the Senate to block any undesirable proposals. The Senate's Rule 22, the cloture rule, required the support of three-fifths of the senators to close off debate and force a vote on a piece of legislation. That meant 38 senators, working together, could ensure that the Senate never even held the vote on a pending bill. Southern Democrats, allied with a handful of arch-conservative old guard Republicans and a few uneasy Midwestern Democrats, could stymie progress on civil rights legislation. Nor did it seem likely that the leader of the majority party, Senator Lyndon Johnson of Texas, would help pass a civil rights bill. During his previous 20 years in public life, Johnson had opposed all proposals to strengthen civil rights protections. In his youth, he had lived with and worked among Texas's migrants, sharecroppers, and bone-weary farm laborers. In 1928, he taught Mexican-American students at a local school in Cotilla. He may even have had personal empathy for the plight of minorities. But politically, he had always stayed loyal to the abiding principles of the South, that race relations were best handled locally by people who knew the South and its ways, and that outsiders from the federal government had no legal right, and certainly no moral right, to compel the South to change. Johnson parroted these nostrums out of expediency. He knew that the way to augment his personal power in the Senate was to lead the Southern Caucus, and the Southern Caucus demanded strict adherence to this racial code. Johnson followed the rules. However, LBJ's political calculations changed after November 1956, for with the second defeat of Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic Party had lost its national leader. Harry Truman and Averell Harriman, the stalwarts of the New Deal and the Fair Deal, were yesterday's men. John Kennedy, the junior senator from Massachusetts, whose nomination speech on Stevenson's behalf had electrified the 1956 Democratic Convention, and Hubert Humphrey, the 45-year-old tribune of progressivism from Minnesota. Perhaps they were tomorrow's men. But now, today, Johnson saw a vacancy at the head of the table, and he meant to occupy it. To seize the mantle of party leader, to win the Democratic nomination for president in 1960, and then to transcend his Southern roots and become a truly national candidate, Johnson would have to conjure up a great deal of political magic. He would have to unite his own fractious party, bringing Northern liberals and Southern conservatives into at least a tolerable working relationship. He would have to lead them to accept compromises they were inclined to reject. And then, having brought about a degree of unity, he would have to pass new laws, starting with civil rights laws, that would earn him the respect of voters from across the nation. If he did all that, then maybe, just maybe, he could dream of taking the White House. So Johnson's future, if not the country's, depended on passing a civil rights bill. To do that, he had to solve two complicated puzzles. First, he had to take the bill that the administration wanted and draw out its teeth without making the surgery too painful for Eisenhower. Then he had to persuade his Southern colleagues that a defanged civil rights bill should be allowed to come to the floor of the Senate for a vote. They did not have to vote for it, but they had to voluntarily stand aside and let others, mainly Northern Democrats and moderate Republicans, pass the bill and make it the law of the land. His fellow Southerners would thereby raise Johnson to such a level of national prominence that they could be assured he would become president, and all the more able to propitiate Southerners with patronage from the Oval Office. In one of the great ironies of modern politics, the Texas senator, a longtime stalwart of Southern intransigence, now planned to ride civil rights all the way to the White House. 3. Although Eisenhower had announced his intention to submit a civil rights bill to Congress in January, various snares slowed it down. In February and early March, Congress took up the Eisenhower Doctrine request, which required congressional approval of military and economic aid to Middle Eastern states fighting communist aggression. That request did not pass until March 5th. The president's 1958 budget proposal also became an acrimonious topic in Congress, as Eisenhower sent in a budget asking for $72 billion in spending, including $4 billion for foreign aid, one of his passions. Conservatives in both parties whittled away at these numbers. The administration fought back, and not until the fall did Congress strike a budget deal. Meanwhile, the civil rights bill had to be reintroduced in the House of Representatives, hearings had to be conducted, and a new vote held. That finally occurred on June 18, 1957, when H.R. 6127 passed by a vote of 286 to 126, almost exactly the same tally that the civil rights bill had won in 1956. And that bill contained the four key provisions that Brownell had sought, and it now moved on to the Senate. Normally it would have died there, as it did in 1956, but this time Senate leaders connived to keep the bill out of Eastland's Judiciary Committee. Noland made a motion to place the bill directly onto the Senate calendar, a preliminary to its being debated. Noland's motion passed, its path cleared by LBJ, who had marshaled just enough votes to ensure the bill would not be derailed into Eastland's graveyard. Noland and Johnson, though bitter foes, each had reasons to see the bill move forward, And so, by the end of June, the U.S. Senate looked likely to do something it had not done for the better part of a century: debate a civil rights bill. But from then on, progress slowed. In a telephone conversation on June 15th, Johnson had tried to warn the president of the coming conflict. The majority leader told Ike that he wanted to work mainly on passing appropriations bills, because the rest of the summer would be taken up fighting on the civil rights bill. Tempers were already flaring, he said, and would be worse. The country's business was likely to be suspended while that debate roiled. Eisenhower didn't seem to grasp why the bill would stir up controversy. He had repeatedly declared that his administration's civil rights proposals were moderate, that they aimed chiefly to protect the right to vote as expressed in the 15th Amendment. During the spring, he repeated his view that the civil rights bill threatened no one. In it is nothing that is inimical to the interests of anyone. It is intended to preserve rights without arousing passions and without disturbing the rights of anyone else. To Johnson's warnings of an impending battle, Eisenhower replied that he devised and approved what he thought was the mildest civil rights bill possible. He stressed that he himself had lived in the South and had no lack of sympathy for the Southern position. He said he was a little struck back on his heels when he found the terrific uproar that was created. If the president did not understand how the South viewed his moderate civil rights bill, he found out on July 2, 1957, when Senator Richard Russell of Georgia rose to speak on the floor of the Senate. This deeply respected, indeed venerated senator, a man who for many, even in the North, embodied the very ideal of the Southern gentleman, who poured his heart and soul into his work on behalf of a threatened Southern way of life, now stood at his desk and launched a devastating attack on the civil rights bill. So powerful were the volleys, so accurate the fire, so explosive the charges that the bill never recovered from the wounds Russell inflicted that day. Russell began by crying foul. The president, he said, had told the country he wanted a bill to protect voting rights, but what the attorney general had sent to Congress was something else altogether. It had been cunningly designed to vest in the Attorney General unprecedented power to bring to bear the whole might of the federal government, including the armed forces if necessary, to force a commingling of white and Negro children in the state-supported public schools of the South. Not only that, but the bill proposed to give the Attorney General such sweeping powers that he could force the white people of the South at the point of a federal bayonet to conform to almost any conceivable edict directed at the destruction of local custom, law, or practice separating the races, and enforce a commingling of the races throughout the social order of the South. At first, Russell's attack sounded like the kind of apocalyptic fear-mongering that one could hear across the South in the 1950s, from tobacco-stained taverns to corporate boardrooms. But Russell was not merely venting racial bile. He went on to dissect with expert skill the most threatening part of the bill. Section 3 was somewhat obscure, and Russell meant to shed light on it. It proposed to give the Attorney General the power to appeal to a federal court for an injunction against any individual who obstructed, or who was planning to obstruct, a citizen's right to equal protection of the laws. If the injunction was then violated and a court order ignored, a judge could assess penalties, including fines and imprisonment, without reference to a jury trial. In essence, it allowed the Justice Department to use the federal courts to bypass local police forces and municipal and state authorities when a citizen's civil rights were at risk. And those civil rights were not precisely defined in the bill, leaving wide discretion to the Attorney General. They could cover school integration, interstate transportation, seating in movie theaters and restaurants, and any number of fields in which the Attorney General decided equal protection was being denied. Russell was right about this. Brownell later admitted in his memoirs that Section 3 gave the Attorney General direct authority to enforce court orders to desegregate public schools and to enter cases such as the Emmett Till murder. This would have been news to Eisenhower, who understood Brownell's bill to be chiefly an augmentation of voting rights protections. Brownell had tried to slip the real import of the bill past the President and Congress. Russell blew the whistle on him, using egregious language. "If you propose to move into the South in this fashion, you may as well prepare your concentration camps now, for there are not enough jails to hold the people of the South who will today oppose the use of raw federal power to forcibly commingle white and Negro children." The following day, Eisenhower regrettably gave credence to the suspicion that he was unfamiliar with the content of his signature piece of legislation. At a news conference, the press asked him to comment on Russell's allegations that the bill was a cunning device to enforce racial integration. "Naturally, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't participate in drawing up the exact language of proposals," he admitted. "I know what the objective was, which was to prevent anybody illegally from interfering with any individual's right to vote." "In that case," asked James Rustin of the New York Times, "should the bill be revised to make it more precise?" "Well," said Ike, "I would not want to answer this in detail because I was reading part of that bill this morning, and there were certain phrases I didn't completely understand." In essence, Russell was right. Ike did not grasp the scope of his own bill. Eisenhower could not have been pleased that Brownell had left him vulnerable to this charge. He called the Attorney General that afternoon, obviously still stinging from Russell's withering criticisms. The notes taken by Ann Whitman reveal that Eisenhower was indeed poorly informed about the purposes of the bill. He insisted to Brownell that for 2 years he had been seeking legislation to allow the Attorney General to halt interference of the right to vote. But now he found the bill was somewhat more inclusive, giving the federal government wide powers, perhaps too wide. "If the bill has been expanded to a form so general that it scares people to death, let us something else again." By the end of the day, Ann Whitman noted, the President was very worried about civil rights. Well, might he worry? His bill was in trouble. When he met with Republican legislative leaders on July 9th, he could see they were wavering. Representative Charles Halleck asked just how important Section 3 was to the administration. Senators Everett Dirksen and Leverett Saltonstall reported that the sentiment in the Senate was running against that part of the bill. Compromise was now a foregone conclusion. The next morning that message was reinforced when Senator Russell met with Eisenhower. No notes were kept of their conversation, but Ann Whitman wrote down a summary afterward. Russell made an emotional case against the bill. Eisenhower emerged from the meeting telling his staff he would be willing to listen to clarifying amendments to the bill as it stands. He is not at all unsympathetic to the position that people like Senator Russell take. The meeting, according to Mrs. Whitman, had restored some measure of friendship between the senator and the president. No wonder Fred Morrow feared a capitulation to the South. Johnson, too, pressured Eisenhower. In a secret meeting, so secret that it was not even recorded in the highly detailed presidential appointment book, Johnson informed the president of the facts of life in the Senate. According to Brownell, Johnson went directly to the Oval Office and told Eisenhower that the entire bill would be defeated on the Senate floor if Section 3 was included. He said he had the votes to do this. The president was convinced and agreed that this provision be dropped. Brownell added, "Eisenhower made this decision without consulting me," a damning comment from the chief field general for the civil rights bill. On July 16th, Eisenhower tried to change the narrative. Russell had successfully defined the civil rights bill as a case of federal overreach and a return to the evil days of Reconstruction. Eisenhower now issued a White House statement that insisted his bill sought mainly to protect the constitutional right of all citizens to vote regardless of race or color. To that end, federal courts should be allowed to enforce their orders, and local juries could not be allowed to stand in the way of such federal enforcement. Beyond that, Eisenhower said, all he sought was assistance in efforts to protect other constitutional rights of our citizens. As tepid a statement of support for the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as one could possibly imagine. In political code words, Eisenhower had publicly invited Congress to toss out Section 3 of the bill in hopes of saving Section 4, which focused on voting rights protections. The normally somnolent Senate began to act. Johnson announced his intention to move the bill to the Senate floor for debate. The Senate passed a procedural vote to make the bill the business of the Senate, a move that came only because Johnson approved it. He promptly served notice that the bill would be amended, knowing that the Senate would move to kill Section 3. Eisenhower seemed unperturbed by these developments, saying the next day at his weekly press conference that in the Civil Rights Bill, the voting right is something that should be emphasized. He backed away from the part of the legislation that strengthened the federal government's hand to enforce school integration. And he strongly repudiated the idea that the federal government would ever have to use force to compel obedience to the law. I can't imagine any set of circumstances that would ever induce me to send federal troops to enforce the orders of a federal court. This public retreat disheartened both the Republicans in the Senate who had been working hard to pass the bill and their liberal Democratic colleagues. Senator Richard Neuberger of Oregon, an outspoken liberal, said in exasperation after Eisenhower's press conference that the president revealed first that he is not thoroughly familiar with the contents of his administration's bill, and second, that he is not enthusiastically in favor of what he does believe the bill to contain. It was a harsh indictment, one now widely shared in the Senate. Ike had thrown in the towel on Section 3. Johnson delivered the coup de grace a week later, allowing a vote on an amendment to cut the offending section from the bill. It passed 52-38, in what the New York Times called a heavy defeat for the administration. Brownell's bold proposal to tip the balance of power from the states to the federal government in the struggle to enforce civil rights had been disemboweled on the Senate floor. The federal government's ability to enforce federal law on school desegregation, racial violence, lynching, intimidation, economic retaliation, and job discrimination had been denied to the nation's chief law enforcement officer. The leader of the liberal forces in the Senate, Paul Douglas, a Democrat from Illinois, bitterly remarked that the death of Section 3 would arouse gleeful pleasure among the advocates of apartheid and white supremacy, but deep sadness amongst those who are struggling for men to live together. 4. Eisenhower had retreated from what he saw as an indefensible position. But he did not leave the field of battle. The position to which he now withdrew, and which he defended with the conspicuous vigor missing so far from the civil rights debate, was the other major part of the bill, the section Eisenhower really did believe in, Section 4, designed to protect the right of African Americans to vote. No person, the proposed law read, whether acting under cover of law or otherwise, shall intimidate, threaten, coerce, or attempt to intimidate, threaten, or coerce any other person for the purpose of interfering with the right of such other person to vote. If such interference occurred or seemed likely to occur, the Attorney General may institute for the United States or in the name of the United States a civil action or other proper proceeding for preventive relief, including an application for a permanent or temporary injunction, restraining order, or other order. Nothing could be simpler. The Attorney General could go to a federal court to get an injunction against any local official who sought to deny black people the privileges of the 15th Amendment. Eisenhower assumed that because he had shown such solicitude for Southern opinion on Section 3, he could now expect a reasonable degree of cooperation on Section 4. He told his congressional allies that he would fight for it. In particular, he wanted to block the Southerners' effort to attach a jury trial amendment to the bill, the purpose of which was to interpose a jury between a judge and a defendant in a contempt case. Typically, judges could issue injunctions and assess penalties in cases of contempt, That is a case of open defiance of a court order without a jury. The purpose of Section 4 was to extend the powers of federal judges to enforce voting rights laws by opening civil or criminal contempt proceedings against anyone who hampered the rights of American citizens to vote. The Southerners devised a clever strategy to blunt the effectiveness of such powers. They did not wish to publicly oppose the right to vote, so instead they shaped the debate as one of an unwarranted expansion of federal power. They conjured up a fearful image of federal judges throwing Southerners in jail without trial. It seemed un-American that a judge could imprison a person without a jury trial, but in fact it was common in contempt cases and entirely legal. No matter. Southerners were joined by pro-labor and liberal senators who were concerned about federal judges overturning workers' rights to strike. There was now a coalition persuaded that the Civil Rights Act would open the door to a dramatic extension of federal judicial power. The administration denied any such purpose in the Voting Rights Bill and also insisted that a jury trial in a case of contempt would dramatically weaken the ability of federal judges to enforce federal voting rights laws in the South, since Southern juries could hardly be relied upon to convict white people for the crime of denying black voters their rights. But these arguments proved hard to sustain against the wily tandem of Johnson and Russell, who prophesied that federal troops would soon be marching across the South to force racial commingling at the end of a bayonet, while jailing without trial the millions of decent Southerners who might be inclined to resist this federal assault on their cherished way of life. Johnson, needing to keep the bill alive while simultaneously gutting it, went back to work, offering incentives, twisting arms, persuading pro-labor senators that union officials who valued the right to strike would also benefit from certain restraints placed on the Attorney General's powers, even appealing to liberal senators that the right to trial by jury was sacrosanct. Whipping together his Democratic forces and winning over a dozen, mostly old guard conservative Republicans as well, on the evening of August 1st, Johnson managed to pass the jury trial amendment in a 51-42 vote. It was a stunning blow to Eisenhower and his team. Not only had they lost the battle for Section 3, but now they had been outmaneuvered on Section 4 as well. In a meeting of his cabinet the next morning, Eisenhower seethed with rage. The vote was one of the most serious political defeats of the past 4 years, primarily because it was such a denial of a basic principle of the United States. He issued a public statement to the press, effectively labeling the Senate action an assault on the right to vote. The result cannot fail to be bitterly disappointing to those many millions of Americans who realized that without the minimum protection that was projected in Section 4 of the bill, many fellow Americans will continue, in effect, to be disenfranchised. The jury trial amendment, which hobbled federal judges from enforcing federal law, would weaken our whole judicial system. In her diary, Ann Whitman called August 2nd the blackest of black days. In a meeting of congressional leaders a few days later to survey the damage, Deputy Attorney General William Rogers called the resulting bill a monstrosity, the most irresponsible act he had seen in his time in Washington. To provide the Attorney General with the power to enforce voting rights but then place local juries in his way was like giving a policeman a gun without bullets. The result would be defiance and mockery of federal power. A few days later, Ike wearily wrote to his friend Bob Woodruff, "The week has been a depressing one. I think the country took an awful beating." It was not only the country, but Eisenhower that had been beaten, twice in 1 week, by Lyndon Johnson. In large part, this defeat occurred because Eisenhower fought on unfamiliar ground, namely Capitol Hill. Nor did his field officers, especially Minority Leader Noland, prove adequate to the task of besting Johnson, perhaps the most gifted parliamentary tactician of his generation. But the defeat may also have been due to Eisenhower's own absence of zeal. Again and again on civil rights he expressed moderate opinions in the face of men whose views were immoderate. He sought gradual change where others sought immediate progress or none at all. He showed dispassionate common sense. His opponents fought with passionate zealotry. It was immensely frustrating for Eisenhower to discover that while his appeal to moderation made him admired in the country as a whole, it disarmed him in Congress. Compromise was the ultimate outcome of most congressional proceedings, but to win even half a loaf, you had to fight fiendishly for a whole one while threatening to burn down the bakery. This was not Eisenhower's style. What remained to him was a depressing and unpalatable choice between vetoing the Civil Rights Bill, his signature legislative proposal for 1957, or signing a weak and perhaps harmful bill into law. For a few weeks he fulminated. He bitterly resented that Johnson had painted him into a corner. He told Republican congressional leaders on August 13th he thought it ironic that the Democrats had succeeded in making it appear that any civil rights legislation that might be enacted would be their proposal. While if he vetoed the bill, he would seem to have opposed civil rights. Of course, that was just what Johnson had intended. Even so, most senior Republicans believed the president had to sign the bill. Nixon and Noland both advised accepting the bill and seeking improvements in a later session. Eisenhower was not so sure. He spoke at length in favor of fighting it out to the end to prevent the pseudo-liberals from getting away with their sudden alliance with the Southerners on a sham bill. But once again, the passion he expressed in the cabinet room did not appear in the public arena, where it counted. Fearful that Eisenhower might indeed veto the entire bill because of the odious jury trial amendment, Johnson threw the administration a small crumb. Working with legislative aides in the Justice Department and the White House, he agreed to tweak the amendment ever so slightly. In the revised language, a jury trial would be triggered in contempt cases only when a judge desired to impose a fine greater than $300 or 45 days in jail. That is, the small fry cases of minor harassment could still be handled by a federal judge without a jury present. But in major cases, in which a judge sought to punish violators of civil rights with real jail time, the defendant could rely on having a jury of his Southern white peers ready at hand to protect him and the ways of the Southland. On August 29th, the final version of the bill passed the Senate 60-15. With only Southern Democrats opposed. Eisenhower reluctantly signed the bill into law on September 9th. The Civil Rights Act of 1957 satisfied no one. Segregationists denounced it, of course. The White Supremacist Citizens' Councils of America issued a statement declaring the act coercive and vicious. Senator Russell railed against the law as heralding a new era of Reconstruction, in which Negro political leaders will direct the attorneys of the Justice Department in an all-out attack on the South. Nonetheless, he boasted that the fight he waged to cripple the measure had been the greatest victory of his 25 years in the Senate. Ethel Payne of the Chicago Defender called the law a Confederate victory, and in a way Russell agreed. The Chicago Defender editorial page said it did not go nearly far enough, as it left intact a wide array of devices the South had used to disenfranchise black voters, from the poll tax to literacy tests. Signing the bill, Eisenhower expressed little pride. "I think the president's view on the bill are well known," a fatigued Jim Haggerty told the press. Not everyone saw the act through jaundiced eyes, however. In a letter to Nixon on August 30th, Reverend King wrote, "The present bill is far better than no bill at all. It was the first civil rights law in 82 years. It created a civil rights division of the Justice Department, a new Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and a bipartisan congressional commission to investigate civil rights abuses. It gave the Attorney General powers to seek injunctions in cases of voting rights violations, though the penalty for such violations would likely remain little more than a gentle wrist slap. and it signaled that the Congress had started to take seriously the crisis in the South. Powerful arguments had been made that Eisenhower should veto the bill because of its flaws. "While I sympathize with this point of view," King wrote, "I feel that civil rights legislation is urgent now." King knew the struggle was not going to be won all at once, nor could many centuries of violence be righted by the stroke of a president's pen. Change would come through a sustained mass movement on the part of Negroes, and would take decades to achieve. Every step toward that goal helped. King thanked Nixon for his efforts on behalf of civil rights, welcoming any sign of progress. "I am sure we will soon emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man, to the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice for all men." 5. The battle over the Civil Rights Act left Eisenhower weary and in need of a break from politics. He looked forward to spending most of September at the naval station in Newport, Rhode Island, where he would have peace and quiet and play a great deal of golf at the Newport Country Club. He imagined leaving the subject of civil rights behind for a while, but at his weekly press conference the day before leaving town, he received a question from Merriman Smith of United Press. Would the president comment on the situation in Arkansas, where the governor has ordered state troops around a school that a federal court had ordered integrated? The school in question was Central High School in Little Rock. Eisenhower said he first heard of the matter that very morning, and the attorney general was looking into it. Then, in his practiced way, he equivocated. "The decision in Brown versus Board of Education must be executed gradually according to the dictum of the Supreme Court. But everyone must remember, you cannot change people's hearts merely by laws." Every reporter in the room had heard this sort of doublespeak many times from the president. Anthony Lewis of the New York Times pushed a bit harder. "Did the president have any plans to take a personal part in the problem of school integration?" he asked. "Did he plan to speak out, to guide, in short, to lead?" Ike refused to make any moral judgments on the matter. Certainly, he said, the Supreme Court's decision must be obeyed. But there are very strong emotions on the other side. People that see a picture of a mongrelization of the race, they call it. They are very strong emotions, and we are going to whip this thing in the long run by Americans being true to themselves, and not merely by law. Hearing these words, it was impossible to divine Eisenhower's beliefs on the subject of desegregation. He respected the Supreme Court's role in interpreting the Constitution and believed he had a duty to implement the Brown decision. But he seemed no less insistent that customs and habits of the South be respected as well. Was there common ground here? Eisenhower did not say. He preferred to reassure everyone that being American was enough to solve the country's problems. And with these baffling and contradictory phrases lingering in the air, he departed for a New England vacation. It would not be a restful one. Few could have predicted that the nation's greatest crisis over school desegregation would break out in Little Rock, Arkansas. Some cities in the state had already started along the road of gradual compliance with the Supreme Court demand to integrate the public schools. The University of Arkansas had admitted black students, and school boards in Fayetteville, Hoxie, Fort Smith, Van Buren, Ozark, and North Little Rock had made modest progress on school desegregation with little public outcry. In 1955, the Little Rock School Board adopted a plan to implement a very gradual, indeed token, desegregation of Central High School, but not the junior high or elementary schools, starting in fall 1957. In Little Rock, however, a white segregationist group, the Capital Citizens Council, was formed in 1956 and put heavy pressure on Governor Orville Faubus to block the integration plan. The group also sponsored the Mothers League of Central High School, which vocally opposed integration. Faubus, a 47-year-old Army veteran from the Ozarks in just his second two-year term, had a record as a moderate on race relations, at least in Southern terms. But he was facing a stiff challenge from a rabid, race-baiting state legislator named Jim Johnson, who planned to use the segregation issue to win the next gubernatorial election. Faubus calculated that his political fortunes would be improved if he openly took sides on the issue.